This episode is brought to you by Taste Washington. With more than 235 wineries, 65 restaurants, and some of the nation's most talented chefs, Taste Washington is the ultimate taste test. Learn more at tastewashington.org.
I'm HRN's Communications Director Kat Johnson with a preview of this week's episode of Meat and Three, our weekly food news roundup. This week, we're celebrating Valentine's Day. Whether it's your favorite day of the season or you avoid it like the plague, there's no debating it's a big day for the world of food and hospitality.
Valentine's Day is what we refer to in the industry as a blackout day.
I don't feel that my manlyhood is threatened when I order a glass of rosé or, God forbid, a rosé champagne.
It's an old Jamaican drink from way back, and we just decided to bring it back into existence. A drink that the men, they believe it really does wonders.
Tune in to this week's Meat and Three on Heritage Radio Network. That's M-E-A-T plus sign T-H-R-E-E. Available wherever you listen to podcasts.
Welcome to the Grape Nation, your weekly wine journey. Our guest is Pascaline Lepeltier. We'll talk to Pascaline about the whole world of wine. We'll taste a couple of fun things for our weekly wine sip. Pascaline brought in a Pinot Donis from the Loire, which we'll talk about, and we'll be sipping a Pet Nat during the show. I'm your host, Sam Ben Ruby. Stay with us for the Grape Nation on the Heritage Radio Network. We bring wine to the people. All right. Our guest is Pascaline Lepeltier. Pascaline holds a master's degree in philosophy and is a master sommelier. Pascaline worked her way in wine and restaurants in Europe and to the U.S. in 2009, landing at Rouge Tomat. She recently received the MOF. How do I pronounce that?
I'm not sure you can pronounce it in English, in fact.
Meilleur ouvrier de France?
Yeah, you can't really pronounce the acronym, is what I heard, because it's kind of a slang word that is not very polite.
Okay.
But you can say it's meilleur ouvrier de France.
Meilleur ouvrier de France. Let me finish the intro. Which translated is the best craftsman of France. And they have multiple categories, and Pascaline got it in the sommelier category. She also received the Best Sommelier of France. These are two of the top awards in her field, and really, she's the only woman to receive them. Pascaline also makes a Finger Lakes Pet Nat called Chapika with Nathan Kendall. She's co-authored The Dirty Guide to Wine with Alice Ferring, and is the managing partner at Racine's in New York City. In my mind, Pascaline is one of the most respected, admired, awarded, and loved people in all of wine. So, Pascaline, I want to welcome you back to the Grape Nation. The reason I asked you to come on is this is our 100th show, and I couldn't think of a better person to ask than you, except I kind of effed up. It's really our 101st show because I don't know how to count. But technically, you're my true love, and this is, you know, our 100th show. So that's why you're here. So welcome, and
Thanks.
Welcome back. Thanks. All right, so you've had a pretty remarkable 2018, and, you know, rolled right into 2019. Congratulations on all that. Let's talk about some of your recent accomplishments. The first being the MOF, the Meilleur Ouvrier de France, or whatever
Beautiful.
It is,
yeah.
And the Best French Sommelier Award. Let's start with the MOF. I don't think a lot of people know what that is. So just tell me quickly, you know, what it is. And I'm really curious about the process. What you have to do? Is it time consuming to study? Is it a long test? Give me a little background on that.
Yeah, the MOF is something very specific to France, and I got that in my mind since, in fact, almost I started to work in the restaurant industry. So for people outside of France, they don't really know what it is. It's a recognition created by some people in the 1920s in France, when they realized that some of the crafts were not recognized to their real value. And the idea was to do an exhibition for craftsmen like carpenter or tailor or glass stainer and say, oh, there is real talent and tradition and excellence in this field, and the state should recognize them and they should do a masterpiece.
And there's many, many categories. You mentioned Absolutely. A few that are so diverse.
There is more than 200 categories today. Wow. And some of the most famous are the chef, for example. So Monsieur Joël Robuchon was the MOF, Monsieur Paul Bocuse was the MOF. So the idea of that is not a competition, it's an examination where the idea is you are excelling through years of experience in your field, that you are recognized by your peer, but also by the Education Nationale, which is like the state itself. You go through a series of tests where you are showing your talents, but also your ability to mentor, to understand the tradition, and to foresee the future of your craft. And it's a very, very well-respected diploma in France. You can see it when you visit France. There will be in a window you are allowed to wear the color of the country. So you have the little flag that you can put on your window or in your uniform. And it's really, I think it's something very special. And I was really, was one of the big objectives of my career one day to be an MOF, yeah.
Is it a competition or... How does it work?
No, absolutely not. It's an examination, and it's a very fair examination.
Are you invited or you apply?
So you apply. You need to have a certain age and experience in your
right.
field. And then you apply, and it's a very public. It's like the state, France, the French state is organizing the diploma. So you know in type of test you're going to have. You go, you apply, you go, and then there is a first round of qualification. That happened in January 2018. We went through... Some tests, some service tests, some tasting tests, and a lot of theory. But the thing is not only sommelier theory, it's more about culture. So
right.
I had a question about a poem, and I need to know which poet wrote that, or which was the Minister of Agriculture, or which church was in a picture that was in a vineyard. So it's really about knowing the wine in its cultural context in
everything
France.
That encompasses it.
Yeah, and
right.
gastronomy, and you can see the sauce and the prepare, like everything. So that was the first round. And we were like, I think more, a little bit more 75 or 80. And we were 9 to be qualified to go to the
right.
final. And the final was in September. And the final was a mix of... like we don't realize a masterpiece as a sommelier. Like so,
right.
when you are a pastry chef doing it, or when you are a chef doing it, or when you are, I was mentioning carpenter. So they're telling you you have to realize a masterpiece, and we don't really have that for us.
The other things have more tangible things.
Yeah, tangible
you're
things.
Right.
So our masterpiece is to do a service. So the final is in two parts. You have 7 to 9 tests that are going to be theory, blind tasting, classic thing, also management negotiation, or how to train your staff, or how to make cocktails, or stuff like that, more classic to competition, but always with a more like broader spirit. Like, for example, I had a blind tasting of a dish. So the task was you get into a room and you have a dish, and you are, of course, graded by MOF chef and
right.
sommelier and the whole like top of the industry, and they're like, okay, so can you tell us about this dish? When do you place it in the history of French gastronomy? Who created that dish? And then you have a wine list, and they're like, out of this wine list, which wine would you recommend with that dish and why?
God,
and
the depth.
Which other pairing will you do? And the dish was a dish created by Alain Sandrins, for example. And Alain Sandrins created a special pairing for that dish with a sparkling wine with a champagne blanc de blanc. And it was only one champagne blanc de blanc on the wine list I was given. So you need to know the dish, you know.
Wow.
So that was half of the notes. And the real masterpiece is you have a real service. So you are given... it's like a 4 to 5 hour service. You discover that the morning of, you are given a commis and a chef de rang. You met them an hour before service.
Wow.
You discover the menu an hour before service. You discover the wine list an hour before service. And then you are graded from A to Z, where you are graded from your ability to do the lineup with them, to prepare the, your tables. And then you do a service to of two tables, the full service, and you are graded. And that's a big deal. And that was very scary.
Is this a multiple-day test?
Yeah, that went on 2 days.
It did. And there was a lot to it, obviously. Well, congratulations on that. I think you gave people a little idea of, you know, how intense it is and how broad, which leads me to the best French sommelier, which you also won. And I think that goes back to a little more tradition of tasting, theory, and service. Is that how?
Yeah, absolutely. The best French is in that case, it's a competition. And so it's all the tasks that you know that you have seen, like, you know, the competition.
Right.
So, yes, a bit more broader and very French. This year was cool because we did also have to do coffee service and beer service and all this kind of thing. So, and it's on stage. But that was a bit more classic. I think the MOF is really the most difficult because it's not only you knowing. You can be the best tester or having incredible sommelier theory, but if you're not a good manager, a good host, and a good teacher and good mentor, you will never get the MOF. It's really right. Showing your ability to give back your knowledge to others in your field. So,
was that something you wanted to do too? Go back to France and compete for the best sommelier? Like, why wouldn't you compete best US, best world? Can you?
So best world maybe in 3 years.
Okay, two next year. Okay.
No. Why? Because, you know, I always want to learn more, and I think it was time for me to continue to learn more. And that challenge of the MOF, especially. So I passed the best French, but the first French was, I decided to do it just because it was at the same timing as the MOF, so I could train for both at right. the same time, and it was more training just for me. And I happened to win, so it was fantastic. But I think I'm just always searching and to learn more.
I was just going to say, you like the idea of being pushed to have to learn new things and new challenges to round out. You have an appetite.
Yeah, I think so. And then for the MOF especially, and my position right now between managing and teaching, I realized that being away from France, I also forgot a lot of very important things in terms of the French traditional way of serving wine and thinking about wine.
Right.
And going back to the MOF, it took me, it was a two and a half years preparation. For both exams. And it was a daily preparation. And I read so many books about heart of pairing, about the history of my country, about culture I totally forgot. I went into like training with a bunch of people that I would have never done that otherwise. And I did that because I knew if I wanted to be better at my job today, with my team, with my guests, it was an amazing opportunity for me to do so. And it forces me to do it. I met really incredible people all over the world to train. I went to England to train, to France to train. I went to a bunch of areas. I went to Canada to train, to California. And at the end, it's not the end thing is not having another diploma, which, you know, it's great.
It's the knowledge gained.
It's a knowledge gain and continuing to say that you can always improve.
Right. And there are other opportunities and competitions and awards that will help you continue to grow, right?
Yeah, I think so. And I wanted to go back to France a little bit because I'm also French and I love my country. And
right.
And for me, France is quite difficult to... It was important for me to go as a woman and to win in France because...
first woman, right?
Yeah.
To win both. Right.
Yeah.
That's a big deal, Pascaline.
I think that was a...
You know, I mean, that's part of the deal too. So just a quick thing. So a couple of years ago, you said you started preparing. So a few years ago, you made up your mind that in a few years, I'm going to do this. So I really need to carve out some time during the day and week and start prepping for this, right?
Yeah. Okay.
All right. So in addition to that... I think right at the beginning of this year, the French magazine La Revue de Vin de France awarded you Personality of the Year for 2019. Very cool. And let's not discount the fact that you were the first person inducted into the Heritage Radio Hall of Fame
yes.
by the Grape
yeah.
Nation. Let's not diminish that. That MOF schmemof, okay? Forget about that. All right. So... Listen, it's been years where you've, you know, achieved and accomplished all these things. I know you're a very heady person. What I'm curious about is When you take all of this stuff, which gives you even more credibility, knowledge, recognition, respect, and all of that, what's the most important thing you could do now? Now that you have all this attention, all this respect, admiration, you know, what are the messages that you want to send out, or what can you do? I mean, you mentioned the word mentoring more than a few times, but how do you take this cloud and really use it to the best advantages?
Yeah, that's a very good question. So, you know, I think I'm an extraordinarily lucky person. I do the job I want. I have an incredible amount of freedom and respect for my partners, and I can really create something at Racine with them. But it's true that I did that also to have a bit more voice, because I also feel a very heavy responsibility. So maybe it's not very fun, but I really feel that being part of the wine world and seeing how wine is produced and how agriculture is done today and how food and beverages are handled, I really feel that I have to help and to push a certain way of thinking of the future for all that. I really believe that we live in a crazy world in terms of food and bev. We crappy food, and like, it's extraordinarily depressing to see
how we farm and
I'm part of this industry. I'm at the end of this industry because I'm feeding people in my restaurant and I'm giving wine to people to my restaurant. And all that I'm trying to do today is to say, okay, you know what, I tasted all this wine and I'm tasting always all this wine and all that, and not only there is the wine that I deeply believe are better in terms of taste, are also better for the environment. And we need to support that. We need to help people to realize that they can change little things little by little, not maybe by going voting, but doing something plus. And this is what I want to use everything I do so far, is to put on a table the work of really agriculture that is trying to give us a future for tomorrow, because we are going into a war. Like, if you really see about the extraordinary damage of the monoculture, intensive clonal agriculture, the over abuse of chemical fertilizer or chemical pesticide, it's not only just like words.
It's real.
Really is real. There is a direct impact today in the environment. There is a direct impact in health. There is a direct impact in so many layers of the industry. It's not normal that the same company owns the seeding industry down to the medication industry. Like, there is something really, really fucked up here.
To the weed killing.
So everything. There is something, and we have, and I feel that responsibility, and that responsibility is leading by example, by teaching, by educating people to relearn how to taste well. Because I believe it's not only by talking, it's just by giving you something good at a decent price, because you support it, maybe not a brand, maybe not something you know, but something that you're going to like, and it's going to be good for you and good for the environment and for the social world too. Like, so that's my next, that's really what's motivate me to do what I do. It's not to open wine for the 1%. It's absolutely becoming meaningless.
So is that, I had a question that was further down the list, but I guess the question is, you know, makes sense now. How are natural wines and the natural wine movement doing now since you've been in New York for 10 years? What you've stated, has there been an uptick in that? More interest? People are educated? They're interested? Is there still a long way to go? I mean, people like you are changing it. But how is the movement?
No, that's extraordinary what happened with natural wine, because everybody knows now. Like ten years ago, you had to explain. Like, today, it's been mainstream. You saw it in press, in media, in magazines. So the world has been there. So that's great. But it's just the beginning. It's maybe not enough, because for most of people, when you think about natural wine, you are just thinking about an aesthetic and a certain taste of wine that we are going to say without any sulfur, like to make something short. But it's kind of forgetting something also at the base, which is the idea of doing wine with no additives is because you had really fantastic grapes and you had the right farming to allow you to do so. And sulfur is not really a problem today. What's the problem is how we grow the grapes.
So I don't mean to interrupt, but now is a good time for you to give us your definition of natural wine, and you sort of covered it. I mean, it involves the farming, the winemaker, you know, agriculture in the cellar. I mean, what are the important, you know, elements that supports what's important to you?
So unfortunately, I don't think natural wine is the right word anymore, because it has been over-abused by also people that are trying to sell you wine, telling, oh, it's natural because there is no sulfur. But they forget to tell you that the grape are not organically grown or biodynamically grown, or they forget to tell you that they may have had other additives that are not sulfur. So unfortunately, the very good idealism and first meaning of that word at the very beginning today is a little bit lost because there is abuse.
How do you know? Do you have a reference? How do you refer to it?
You want wine with no sulfur? I can find you wine with no sulfur.
Okay.
I kind of tend to prefer the word that sometimes Alice or Alice Faring or even Isabelle Legeron are using. I like vin vivant or live, like wines that are alive. Because at the end, this is the idea. It's a whole, the whole thing started when we realized that people realized that wine became so technical and chemical and analogically tricked because the quality of the grape was just not here enough to sustain the production and the volume. So they had to heavily intervene in a winery because the vineyard was overcropped and overabused. So the backup was...
Poor agriculture.
And so the backup was, if we grow without all this artificial help from chemicals and fertilizer, we can probably produce grapes that won't need all this trick in the cellar. And he went back to that with also the idea we can also do it without sulfur, because at the end we can do it with nothing. But the whole debate went on to that sulfur stuff and the taste and all that.
Much attention to sulfur?
It was just people were just, because it was maybe easier to understand, just they were on to that, okay, the main point is the sulfur. No, the main point is, do we farm properly? With a future for the soil that we are farming? And are we lying in terms of that? Because there is some people just buying grapes and they're absolutely not organic and they're going to tell you there's no sulfur, but because they are cool and there is no legislation and like it's kind of a punk rock attitude, you're going to believe it's natural. But you are going to, if you deeply believe in this feeling of sensation of wine, you're going to say, oh man, there is something wrong. And there is a lot of lie. There is a lot of lie everywhere in the wine world. And unfortunately, it's so complicated to get transparency. There is no labeling. There is couple there is no official labeling of ingredients. There is a couple of certification that you can try to rely on. That if the guy
Demeter,
for example, that you know that this guy can use a list of products. You can go online and say, okay, so you can just use that, and that. That's it. So you kind of know more what's happening. But at the end, the real question is: if you are a farmer and if you want to make wine that are with minimum intervention, you need really to think about what's happening in your land. And this is what I want to support.
It starts there. Period.
It's what I want to support. And there is so much lie. It's incredible. And it's very sometimes depressing because it's a market. And the natural wine market today became a really big market because there is such a success. We are talking about we are talking about money today. And so...
But a lot of the practitioners are not.
I know people that are saying they're natural winemakers and they're buying wine like from somebody else that is absolutely not and they're putting their label on the label.
It's the same with food.
There is no transparency.
You go into a supermarket and it says natural. It means nothing.
So that's the deal. It's like, how do we do? It's a concept today. It went like we don't really know even when we try to know. So what's the future? What can we do to continue this movement? Because once again, we go into a world if we continue to think about the monoculture agricultural system we currently have. Do we need to drink less? Do we need to consume less? Do we need to drink better? And I believe in that, but that means that every person opening something needs to be satisfied with what that person is opening and drinking. So it passes by the education of the palate. And maybe you won't be able to buy your fancy Chardonnay from I don't know which way in the world, but maybe you are going to like this very other wine from that other grape that is not as famous and fancy for not that brand, but you know what, you're going to really love it and you're going to be able to support something else. And that's a big fight today. And it's a real fight, I have to say. There is a lot of lobbying going behind our back. And just to give you an example, today in Europe, in France at least, it's forbidden to sell heirloom seeds. It's over. You have to buy seeds from specific catalogs. Same way, if you want to plant vineyard, if you want to have subvention from Europe, you have to plant clonal selection, unless you buy, like, get some selection massal from your own vineyard. So let's say I want to plant a vineyard, I have my acreage, my neighbor has amazing old vine, Chenin, that I want to plant, and I say, oh, and they've been tested, and you know, they're old vine, and I want to get a massal selection from that. It's not, I can do it, but I won't have any help from the state. I will have help if I buy clonal material.
That's so, the only way. So they'll
only
support
way.
You
so
if you buy.
If you buy
that
the
encourages
system,
nothing.
That encourages nothing. And so this is where, and people don't realize how much now we are, our choices are more and more limited.
Wow, that's amazing. I didn't realize that. And then you have people like Isabel who, you know, have a raw wine fair around the world, and she sort of sets up some requirements, restrictions. Mm-hmm. The wineries that participate fall under a lot of what you describe.
Yeah, and I think it's a necessity, but it's also a necessity for us as buyer. You know, I think we need to be more demanding. If you want to, like at the end, if you want. I think we should, because I think I'm responsible for what I'm giving you to drink. It's not innocent. No, I'm going to give you something that you're going to absorb. Your body is going to absorb it. I think we have a very big responsibility toward that, you know.
People don't give a crap.
But I give a crap.
No, I know.
And I think we should be more aware of that. I think chefs are more aware of that. I think there is movement with chefs and and sommelier in a certain way. I think there is definitely people that are totally following natural organic biodynamic. But this idea of having no sulfur absolutely kind of took them to a certain extremism that is not healthy. I don't think extremism are healthy. I think ideology are not healthy. So saying the no sulfur is a way is not necessarily healthy. Everything is gray. Nothing is black and white. I don't like this idea of pure purity. And so instead of trying to get in the middle, saying, oh, maybe this guy is putting 20 part or 30 part millions of sulfur, but the vineyard is extraordinary and is working in permaculture and is really trying to recreate a biodiversity, you know what? I don't mind the 30 part per million.
Right. That's like, it's sort of inconsequential.
Absolutely.
The bigger picture is more positive and everything. You know, there's places like your place, Racine's, Frenchet, Contra Wild Air, where, you know, the selection is incredible. But there's still, and I ask a lot of the somms that come through on the show, the mainstream and legacy type restaurants, they're just not really interested. I don't think their clientele, you know, they want Burgundies, which, by the way, are practitioners.
But I think I don't think you can say today you don't have the clientele, because there is extraordinary high quality wine made this way everywhere in the world.
Right, people don't realize that.
So,
for many decades and maybe longer.
At least for a couple of years. So if you're on Champagne, if you're on Burgundy, if you're on Alsace, if you're on they are here.
Right.
But they may not be the most famous brand, but they are here.
Right.
So if you really want to do it, you can do it.
All right, so let me just jump to another topic and let's talk about this one for a minute or two, and we broached it before a little. How are women doing in wine today, as an industry? Are women getting their props? Are they still underserved? It's a general question, but what's your feeling?
It's in a way a tough question, because I don't go out that much. I talk with some of my friends and I see what's happening. It's slowly but surely. What is sure is, like, there is way more talented women entering the industry. That's undeniable.
More here than Europe or both?
It's starting to be more in Europe. I have to say, I was very happy to see when I passed the best French. Philippe Forbrac, the president of the French Sommelier Association, invited a bunch of schools. And it was a 50-50 in the room. So in France, it's moving. So I was very happy to see
that.
That's
great, yeah.
So a lot of young girls, young women, it's happening. But it's happening yet, but, you know, it won't be something that we can really talk about until we are achieving the rise to responsibility position. We need to be, we need to have a 50-50 at the head. At the head
and
of a country. It's not, it's happening little by little.
We're not there though.
We are not there. And this is what we need to realize and to see how is it possible, and is it possible that we become the CEOs, we become entrepreneur and at the head of the business, we are owner of our place.
Are you positive it's going in that direction, or it's still a little slower than?
I think it's not only for restaurant. I think as a global thing, it's still, look, how many, but it's getting better. You know, we have still women at the head of international institution and countries. It's happening.
Right.
It's happening. But maybe one more generation with women that we want to make the change. So slowly but surely, and when we will be there, then we can also probably reestablish a different social organization that will allow also to have a family. Like, you know, just something stupid, but like you are mom and you have the kid. Like, if you don't have the right system, the social system, or to make that possible,
right,
to at the same time have the job and
yeah,
to also
you're
raise a family.
Held at a higher demand being a mom and a CEO. Where
and
a guy
that.
Doesn't have to worry about that for sure.
So.
Yeah, hopefully that'll change. All right, we're talking to Pascaline LePeltier, Master Sommelier, Managing Partner at Racine's. We're going to take a quick break, and Pascaline, when we come back, I have a bunch more questions. We'll see if we could squeeze in our wine list, and I want to taste the wine you brought in. So you're listening to The Grape Nation. I'm Sam Ben Ruby. We'll be right back.
This episode is brought to you by Taste Washington. A food and wine lover's wonderland, Taste Washington offers the most wine and food from one single place in one single place. Including samples from more than 35 wineries, 65 restaurants, 60 exhibitors, and some of the nation's most talented chefs, each spring, attendees can drink and eat their heart out over 4 days brimming with specially curated events that highlight the best of Washington State. The result of a continued partnership between Visit Seattle and Washington State Wine, Taste Washington is taking place March 28th to 31st, 2019. Mark your calendar for this year's lineup featuring The Red and White Party, Taste Washington on the Farm, The New Vintage, Seminars, The Grand Tasting, and Sunday Brunch. Learn more at tastewashington.org.
Okay, we're back. We're back with my guest, Pascaline LePeltier. Pascaline, I got a lot more stuff to talk to you about. Day-to-day, you're the managing partner at Racine's, which is a terrific restaurant and bar downtown in New York City. Talk to me about what's going on there now. There's been some changes. And talk to me a little about the wine program, of which, of late, you've had your hand in it. So what's going on there? It's certainly become a destination food-wise, wine-wise. It was always there and always did well, but I think now it's at the top of a lot of people's lists.
Yeah, thanks for mentioning. Yeah, so Racine's it's a great adventure. I joined the company like 11 months ago now. And Arnaud Tronge created a place with David Lee from Chambers. We created something very special, like on Chamber Street. Open more like a kind of a bistro, like French bistronomy wine bar with Fred Duca, the original chef. And Fred left us to open his own place in Paris called Rooster. And it seems like an amazing success. So next time I'm in Paris, I'm going to go there. And so it was kind of a transition time. We had Paul Lebrun with us as a chef in residency for a couple of months. It was really great to work with Paul. Brought a lot of attention of the food, and working with such a talent was really special. But now we are back to having our chef, an executive chef, and it's Diego Moya. Diego was known because he had for almost a year, a place called Hemlock on the Lower East Side. And unfortunately, had to close, and serendipity and a friend made us cross path, and now Diego is with us, and I think it's I'm extraordinarily happy because I think we are sharing really the same vision of food and wine. Diego is very heavily committed into extremely tasteful type of food. He trained in France. He's like New York, like Long Island grown, but traveled the world, worked in farms, studied permaculture, has a deep belief in what that means to cook the real ingredients, to work with the right producer. Also this idea of to use the whole ingredient itself, to try to be as much as possible a no-waste restaurant in terms of the ingredients.
Right.
Producing in-house butter, bread, and using all the technical fermentation. And he loves wine. So the idea is really finally we are kind of putting together something what is very coherent, and what David and Arno started with a program, and I think I even push it. Like I was on the same thing, but brought a new energy saying, okay, we want to work with real farmers at every level, from food to wine to spirits to beer, where we know what we are giving to you, what's the story behind it, why that wine is on the list is because we know the producer, we visited it, we have a direct relationship, we know how they work, how hard they work, what is their commitment, once again, to preserving their land. And so for you to have a very specific experience. And what we are trying to do is, of course, there is names, there is fantastic, famous, iconic producer on the list, but also there is people that you won't know, and we are being searching, we are being pushing.
So David and Arno know their stuff.
Off, yeah.
But you come in, what kind of touches, or what did you push for, or was there not enough Shannon? I mean, tell me some of the changes.
I grew up the Chanelist a lot. Yeah, there is a lot more Chanel.
There is. Yeah, so that right off the bat, there's more. Boom. There's not just Shannon, there's Shannon. Yes.
I think we are like, I think we have 460 references of Loire Valley just on the
Jesus.
List.
Jesus.
I think we're the biggest Loire Valley list in America.
So that's growing. That's one obvious thing. What else?
If
people say, you know, Pascaline's touch, what else would you say since you've been there almost a year?
I think you can see my touch in even a little bit more organic and biodynamic producer.
Okay.
From areas of the world, from Eastern Europe, from other like less known area of France. I grew up also the Southwest list.
So answer this question.
Yeah.
'Cause so tell me about some wines, winemakers, grapes, regions that are exciting you right now. You, Pascaline, for the restaurant, because that's sort of what you were alluding to. And I think those are the wines that you're bringing in. We could probably spend two shows talking about it, but just give me, you know, a region or two, a wine,
what
a grape.
We're looking.
Yeah.
Yeah, like we have been doing some research with David and Eben was really great. From everything white from the south. So looking for freshness in the south, a new place in the Roussillon, white Fougère, all these grapes that people don't really think about, and they're making really fantastic things.
So we're talking south of France,
south
Roussillon,
of France, Rhône.
White, okay.
A lot of Rhône.
Okay.
We've been looking a lot in the Rhône. Been looking also in Alsace. Eben has been doing extraordinary work in Alsace, and I have to say it is a bunch of new stuff and producer with him. So Alsace is going to be a big specialty with really things that you can't find anywhere else. We are going to try to also bring some special thing from the Southwest because I'm really a big, big, big Mansang freak. I love that grape. I think the Southwest of France.
Mansang?
Mansang, yes.
M-O-N-S-A-N-G?
M-A-N-S-A-N-G. So there is some special things that we are going to bring from that. More people from the Loire. So I've been really focusing more on France for the moment.
Okay.
Well,
it's sort
here.
Of the wheelhouse of the restaurant.
Yeah.
You know, French is where you're going to have your strength and all of that.
So, yeah, and Auvergne. We are looking a lot in Auvergne right now.
So you answered that question well. You packed in a lot there. And as I tell all my listeners, I'll post everything on our social media, the wines we talked about, what we're drinking and all that stuff. So exciting things at Racine's for sure. Definitely a destination, like I said. You're also making an organic pet nat from native grapes up in the Finger Lakes, We're talking about Southwest France and Roussillon, and but you were just up there, I think, this week or last week, in the Finger Lakes, and you're making a pet gnat called Chepika, C-H-E-P-I-K-A, with Nathan Kendall, who's a very respected winemaker up there. Tell me a little about that. How many vintages have you made? What inspired you to do it?
Yeah, that's our baby project, our love project with Nathan. The idea came when I was still at Rouge, my previous restaurant, Rouge Tomate, when I was really trying to think about how can I have local wine that could be organic and also price-wise still be reasonable. And it was a very difficult question because organic certification is quite rare in New York State. And was brainstorming with I already knew Nathan and really liked the wine, and Nathan told me, listen, what about we trying to do something with some of our, they are called native, but they are real hybrids. They are original hybrids because they are not 100% American grapes. They have been crossed with vinifera.
But they're hybrids. They're not native, but they've been up in that area
for many years.
For
a long time, absolutely. And so and we said to Luke, and he found that organically certified vineyard where these grapes were used for table grapes. And the two grapes they we thought about were Catawba and Delaware.
What's the second one? Spell it for me.
Like the state.
Delaware. Oh, Delaware. Okay.
Yeah, sorry for my accent.
Are they both red or the Delaware
is
white?
They are pinkish. Like the Catawba is very pink.
That's an old upstate wine. Grape.
For sure.
Catawba.
But it's a historical grape of, and it was considered the first grape of American wine history because massive amount of wine were made with Catawba in the mid-19th century, sparkling wine in Ohio. And I'm talking about million of cases.
Really?
And Nicolas Langworthier was sending even the wine to France. So we decided to do that, and we made it a pet gnat, not because of the style, but because we didn't want to make a pet gnat. We wanted to make a wine with as little intervention as possible and see, okay, if you take these grapes and that organic and you treat them properly, what can we do and can we make something delicious? And yes, it could be delicious. And the best way in that two vintages, 16 and 17, was to make it a sparkling. And
16 was the first?
16 was the first, 16 and 17. So it was a pet gnat because it just worked like that. The fermentation went very quick.
And you were happy with the first vintage, way the 16 came out?
We were so happy. We were so surprised.
You were? It was better than you
thought. Yeah, better than we thought. But it was the first time.
Did you have to make any tweaks for the 17?
Like no, less.
Less.
Yeah,
Nathan. That's a great sign.
Yeah, less. No, like 10 parts per million at press for 16, nothing for the 17. And for 18, unfortunately, I wasn't there for harvest because I was in France for the exam.
Right.
And 18 was a really complicated vintage in the Finger Lakes. It was really, really, really
hard. As far
hard.
As weather and
sour rot and
really?
Very rainy the second half.
And were so the yields lower?
Yields low, a lot of sorting. And so Nathan didn't feel confident to do the pet gnat. So we made a rosé.
Oh, great. So a still rosé?
This year is a still rosé.
Okay. So tell people if they want to try this, the best places to get it.
So Chepika.
Restaurants?
A few retailers? A few retailers. I think the pet gnat is almost sold out today.
Okay.
We make nothing. You know, the project...
What's nothing? Like 200-300 cases?
Yeah, 200 cases.
Okay.
Because the project is less about massive production than to say maybe there is alternative. If you farm properly and you care about these grapes, you can make something that can be your table wine. And because they are growing everywhere in the Finger Lakes. You know, Finger Lakes is probably only 25% vinifera. The rest is hybrids and the rest is native. So it's a crazy amount of grapes growing that are destined to table, like table grape or jam or juice or all that. Some of them are organic. Some of them also needs less treatment. So why don't we try to do something with that instead of forcing nature with new hybrids or new stuff and new stuff? Well, stuff are growing very well by them, like not by themselves, but... Our vineyard, where we get the grape from, is probably 100 years old. Like the vineyard is, the vine is probably 100 years old. So
anybody would die for a vineyard like that.
Yeah, and so it's more offering a new perspective. The idea is not to make money. The idea is just to say, why not trying?
Right.
Why not trying farming properly and making the wine with care?
Could do it anywhere.
And so let's see the result.
So are there aspirations to take Chapika and maybe try to make something somewhere else? Or
No, it's really over there. Like it's really, Nathan is over there.
Right.
But no, if you can inspire other people. We were inspired by Deirdre Hakin, like the garagist in Vermont, and what she was doing. So she planted her vineyard and worked with hybrid and make a superb stuff. We decided just to say, hey, instead of trying to force something, why don't we try to work with what's grow well? And make it good.
Right.
And so it's another way of thinking, I think, about
that. That's the best thing for everyone. Great for the land, great for the final product and all of that. All right, one last thing, and I think we could do our little wine list, and I'm very curious to see what you're drinking. How's your book, The Dirty Guide to Wine, doing? My follow-up question really is it an ongoing project where at some point you'll update it, or you've just been so busy with everything else?
I think we need to ask Alice about that. I'm not sure that the publisher wants to. I'm not sure. We would love to, but
right.
I'm not sure the publisher. So I know Alice has been working on a Japanese translation.
Oh, really?
Okay. It's going to be in Japanese.
So if you could grow the book around the world, that would be great.
Yes, that's happening right now. Yeah.
And let's just explain to people. The book's called The Dirty Guide to Wine. It's with Alice Fearing. And it is really a wine book that gets into how the dirt and the soils have an incredible effect on the wines. Is that a fair description? Give me a better one.
Yeah, no, it's a very good intro, and just discovering the world of wine not through the grape or the varietal, not
right.
through the appellation or history, but saying, oh, what underground matters, and we classified the world of wine through the three main soil types that you can find in the world. So suddenly you are connecting wine region. You were never connected otherwise because you would have never thought that the granite from the Muscadet can have something to do with
right.
the granite from the Rhone or the granite from Galicia. And suddenly you are just designing new perspective for the way you taste wine.
Right. It's as in-depth a book about the soil and the rock and the stone that wine grows in and the effects that it has on the wine. And it's so amazing in different areas and different types of stones and soils. I recommend that. We had you and Alice on the show, I think about a year ago, to talk about the book. All right, Pasca, while I have you here, let's subject you to our wine list and let's see what the hell you're drinking and doing. We ask our guests the same five questions. Don't obsess over these, but give me your best answers. And the first question is, what are you drinking now? And that is for the restaurant, in your fridge, what you're curious about. Is it seasonal? What are the few things that you're drinking now? Not right here.
Now. I'm still drinking a lot of beer.
Beer?
Yeah.
Okay, you like a certain kind of beer. Aren't you a sour beer fan?
I am a sour beer fan.
Okay, so you're drinking sour beer. You love Cantillon?
I love Cantillon.
What else? So that's one answer. Give me a wine.
It'd be my... My God, what I'm drinking. Drinking a lot of, I'm going to be so boring. I'm drinking a lot of Chenin right now.
Okay. Are you trying new things, different producers, different SKUs?
A lot of new producers. No, I'm trying to explore a lot of the grapes. I was mentioning a lot of the Southwest grapes, drinking Verdicchio. I'm looking for alternative for high acid grape variety. So it's what I'm drinking a lot. High acid with structure and bone. So more
because they're good food wines?
They're good food wines. They're great
for
pairing, absolutely. So
right.
exploring Austria, exploring Switzerland, exploring like Northern Italy, like all the kind of under radar white grape variety. Yeah.
All right, so here's the second question. Falls right in, and I'm very curious to compare this to the first time you came on. What is Pascaline's favorite wine and food pairing? Now, it's not something that you eat 50 times a year, but what resonates with you? What's a great pairing? What was, oh, wow, ooh, la, la to you?
Oh my God, there is so many. Such a tough one.
Well, give me any.
Tough one.
You know we have a grape nation rule. No champagne and oysters. Okay, give me something else.
No champagne and oyster. What did I do recently that I found really mind-blowing? You know what? I have just so many.
Give me anything.
Yes,
you got it.
I got it. I did. Okay, it was it's going to sound fancy, but I did this really cool, really mind-blowing workshop with Steven Ramirez from the Tea Dealers, and we paired caviar and a different five different pu'er tea and champagne.
What is that? Oh, pu'er tea. P-U-E-R.
Yeah, yeah. And we had
ripe and raw, both?
We had a raw pu'er tea.
Raw pu'er. With caviar?
With caviar. And that was mind-blowing.
That's a good pair?
Yes.
See, I'm a big pu'er tea aficionado, ripe and raw. I'm trying to think of...
It was really special. There was such a still a brininess in that pu'er that... And there was a kind of a muddiness you also have on it. Like, it was just something really mind-blowing. I was really, really happy. Like, not everybody can do that every day, but I'm exploring that now with Diego, with other...
This is our 100th show, really our 101st show. Nobody's ever given that answer before. You know that, right? Pu'er tea and caviar. For shit sure, okay? But that's a good one. All right, third question. When you work very hard, you travel, you've been competing, tests, all that. Your favorite wine restaurant and or bar? And you don't have to be careful. I don't want you to include or exclude anybody. Just who's doing it well, you know, where you're comfortable, you know, your sensibilities. Can you...
Here? In New York? Or
I guess New York.
I think one of the best pro right now in New York is... I really like Michael Engelman. I think Michael...
At the Modern.
Yeah.
Is a wizard.
Yeah. I think Mike has an extraordinary wine culture. The food at the Modern is really, really stuck. Black Top. The wine list is... really massive, meat on the classic side, but still extraordinary and well created and well priced. So I know where I go there, I was going to have really, really a great experience. After that, I know my friend Linda Violago now is down in Nashville and she's doing like something cool stuff there. And I'm like doing wine.
Wait, say that?
So my friend
in Nashville?
In Nashville.
Restaurant or a bar?
It's a restaurant.
What's it called?
I think it's called the Catbird.
Catbird?
Yeah, and
I think you're right.
I think she's there just like for a couple of months and she's just doing wine pairing. And she's a girl that doesn't like to do wine pairing. And I know if she does it, it must be just insane. So I was like, man, I wish I can go to Nashville to see what you are doing, girls, down. Because
that's pretty enticing.
That, yeah.
All right. Give me, if you had 10 hours in Paris and it was late in the afternoon and you can go someplace for wine first, is there any place that pops into your mind?
Oh, there is a lot. Can I go to multiple? Can I just do a little like
anywhere? Yeah.
There is that new place that I went last time I was in Paris, like 2 weeks ago. Really great, called Goguette.
Spell.
Like Goguette. Goguette.
Great.
Just by Le Cercle d'Hiver.
Okay.
And so you have that. So you can go there, and then you cross and you go to Clown Bar.
Clown Bar has been around for a few years.
Yeah, the subway, and then you go to Ventre. So you can have an early bite with Marco Pelletier. And then one of the places I really like to go to, because it's open super late and 7 days a week, and it's by the train station of Montparnasse. So when I go to Paris to go to my parents, I will stop in Montparnasse. It's called Le Petit Sommelier.
Le Petit Sommelier.
And it's my friend Pierre, and he has really an awesome list. Really, really cool. And it's kind of really just basic brasserie, French, great food. And you have a lot of wine from the world too. You have old vintage, super cool price. And when you're lost in Paris, that's really great to know that this kind of place exists.
So that's how you answer that question. We just gave you a whole night or a couple of nights worth of the best stops. All right, jump to the next question. I don't know if you could answer this with a single answer or multiple answers. And it's not the most... expensive or rare wine, but what's a favorite all-time wine of yours? Sometimes it's the experience, not the wine. What comes to mind?
Yeah, a wine that has some light and is alive. It's a very complicated stuff to feel, but I think today...
Can you state something specific?
Right now, some of the Julien Courtois wine does that a lot for me. It's from the Loire too. There is some Menu Pinot.
Is Julien Courtois the maker?
Yeah. But
spell Courtois for me.
C-O-U-R-T-O-E-S.
Okay. I will post that. What kind of wine is it?
It's an organically farmed North Sulphur wine, the Menu Pinot. But okay. I'm looking for light today in my wine.
Right.
I'm for that vibrancy.
Right. That's what's important to you. Okay. Last question. I think you can answer this. Best wine retail around $15 to $20. Give me a white. Give me a red. I'm sending my 20-something kid to a party. We don't want to give him a crappy bottle of $11 wine. He doesn't have 40. So he's spending 15, 18, 21 bucks. What red are you going to put him on? What white? You can give me a region, Muscadet. You can give me a grape. You can give me a maker. You can give me all of that.
Yeah. So right now, I would say for that price, Domaine Eos. Laguerre. So it's like Eric Laguerre, Domaine Eos, in the Côte du Roussillon.
Spell Domaine Eos.
Sorry, Domaine Laguerre. It's L-A-G-U-E-R-R-E. Okay. And the cuvée is Eos.
Okay.
Extraordinary white
in
and red.
In that price range?
It's like $12.
So red and white.
Red
just
and white.
Stay with that guy.
That, the wine are just insane.
You answered that question with one maker. That's perfect. All right, Pascal, we're going to wrap up the show. I asked you if you'd be so kind enough to bring in a wine. Every week we do a segment. We end the show with a weekly wine sip. We taste a different wine on air. Tell me what you brought in, and then let's give it a quick taste and evaluation. This is something very special, you told me. So let's start glugging this. Amanda, you want to come in and try this?
Yes, yeah, so I thought because we're here at Roberta's, I will bring
you... The color's amazing.
I will bring you a pizza wine.
Yeah.
So that's a Pinot de Nice from the Loire. So Pinot de Nice is this very rare grape that you find mostly on the eastern part of the Loire, but also has a real big history in my around Angers in my region. And that's a wine by Benoît Courreau, one of my dear friends. Benoît attended the same sommelier school than me, but he went into wine and I went into sommelier. And we know each other since 15 years.
Wow.
One of my favorite guys, extraordinary farmers, amazing winemaker. And he replanted Pinot de Nice on Echalas, on Schist, like something crazy. And because it's young vine, he decided to make a rosé. And he made a couple of cases of rosé for that really awesome pizza place in Angers. So if you happen to go to the wine fair in Angers, there is a place called Un Brin Folk. That's
spell for me.
Un Brin, B-R-I-N, space F-O-L-K. So okay. Brin Folk. Like, and he made that really great Pinot de Nice rosé from young vine for this pizza place with nothing.
And tell me on the label what the name is.
It's called Un Brin Fuck on the label. So, right. Of course, the label
F-U-C-K.
Was not authorized here. Right. So we kind of sneak in a secret label that we post, like we glue back new labels
right.
to get
so
it
you can
in.
Get it through. All right, so let's look and taste this wine. So the color is this gorgeous rosé, pinkish, salmonish, right?
Yeah, so Pinot de Nice can be quite pale. So Pinot de Nice is P-I-N-E-A-U, nothing to do with Pinot Noir.
Right.
Nothing to do. Pinot is kind of a word for grape. So it means a grape from Onis. It's a very peppery grape. Not very...
Peppery?
It's very peppery.
All right. So color, it's pale, but it's got some nice color. Give me nose descriptors. Is pepper in the nose or is...
I think so. It's also still quite young and delightful. You get some very, very ripe vine peach on the nose. Really tiny, tiny bit of like almost gardenia.
Right.
Like that white pepper is behind.
Right.
You have a feeling of like almost sun-kissed thing. And a bit of like hibiscus tea.
Right. Very interesting in that sense. Now, mouthfeel, there's some acidity there. And it's a medium. It's got a nice body to it, right?
Yeah, you are in the Loire. You're in the Loire. This was the ripe vintage from the Loire.
Now,
so it's it was 2017.
I need a little more of that.
So ripe vintage, you get that kind of super nice lush attack. So you feel like really crunching that.
Yes.
Vine peach, and then you get this acidity coming through, like almost like white raspberry hibiscus, finishing savory with that white paper. Maybe there is maybe 1 or 2 grams of residual sugar.
When you say white paper, when you smell and taste a piece of paper, is that what you're describing?
Sorry, I'm like, it's my super terrible accent. Like, it's like black crack paper.
Oh, pepper. I'm like, paper? Oh, white pepper, which is more spicy but more subtle than black pepper. Thank God that came at the end of the show, because I would have felt so terrible if it was at the beginning. So it's got that white pepper, which again is a little more, it's the spice, but a little more subtle.
So
in that
think zone. About that wine with a beautiful base of ripe tomato and like mozza and all the basil and oregano and thyme. Like
that's perfect the pairing?
Pizza wine. Oh, but yeah, but you can also
so
white
pizza for sure.
But it's made for a pizza, please.
But what? Right. What about? Can you eat this with sliced mozzarella and tomatoes and basil? Yeah, not on the pizza.
That's such a summertime wine. Like you.
Okay.
Are
what else?
Craving. Like.
What about meal stuff?
Meal stuff. But
meats, chicken, fish.
Yeah, chicken. Like you can definitely do chicken. You will maybe poach it with something quite light. Yeah, will. You can bring a tiny bit of sweetness or spice. You can almost like make it like a very light Thai mix, but not too spicy.
Right.
That would be super nice because there is that natural sweetness in that wine. Just like grill red snapper or like really.
It can hold up to the grilling and the fishiness. No, it's not a fishy fish, but the fish and all that. Yeah, I think the acidity is good. It's pretty versatile.
It's super versatile.
Yeah, I'm very happy with a Roberta's pizza and a bottle of this. you had me sold on that. All right, so just let's tell everybody one more time. You can do a better job than me. What we're drinking again?
Yeah, so it's Benoît Courreau.
Spell his last name.
C-O-U-R-A-U-L-T.
Okay.
It's called Un Brin Fuck. It's
Fuck
not
is
totally
F-U-C-K.
Absolutely.
Right.
Stable wine. It's a Pinot de Nice, and it's made in next to Angers, in the Anjou region.
Which is where you grew up. And not easy to find, right?
I don't think there is any left
is
but
a
that rusty.
Bit of a unicorn. It's a treat, but I think it's fair that we can tell people to seek out Pinot de Nice.
Seek out Pinot de Nice.
It's
an amazing grape.
Terrific wine.
Please, please, please buy Pinot de Nice.
Right.
It needs to survive
so
in the Loire. Yeah.
That's our message. All right, Pascaline, we're going to wrap up. We covered a lot. If you have a question, suggestion, wine happening, or event, hit me up at sam@thegrapenation.com. That's sam@thegrapenation.com. You can follow us on Facebook at The Grape Nation. Follow us on Instagram at SBenRuby and the hashtag The Grape Nation. On Twitter, we're at BenRuby and the hashtag The Grape Nation. Also, you can subscribe to The Grape Nation podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify. Amanda's going to put those up tonight. So you could listen again. We'll post, as I said earlier, Pascaline's wine list, all her answers, and I will give you the very specifics of the wine that we tasted on all our social media sites. Pascaline, where can we find you on social media? Where can we find Racines?
You can find us. You can find me on Instagram at Pascaline Le Pelletier or Racine NY or like it's
RACINESNYC.
Yeah, absolutely. Racine
and
NY.
Twitter, you're P. Le Pelletier.
Yep.
Yep. So Pascaline does not sit still. She's a fun person to follow. She doesn't overpost, but you get a sense of what she's doing when you follow her. All right. I want to thank our guest, Pascaline Le Pelletier. I want to thank Pascaline for coming in to celebrate our 100th
and one
show.
The first of a new
Pascaline, you're one of the few guests. You're in good company with Isabel Legero that have been on the show 3 times.
Wow.
Isabel came for the first Raw Wine Fair. Then I had her back for the second and the third. I sought you out at Isabel's Raw Wine Fair first, and you were gracious enough to get back to me when we were first doing the show, and we became friends since. Yeah. When you came out with the book, I tracked you down, and then when it came time for the 100th show, I didn't want to celebrate with anyone else. So thank you to Pascaline. Thank you to our engineer, Amanda, and everyone at the Heritage Radio Network. I'm Sam Benrubi, and you've been listening to The Grape Nation.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at Heritage_Radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.